From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, we continue our conversation with candidates who won, candidates who fell short, candidates who are still waiting to count all the ballots but feel pretty good about their positions. We'll talk to party chair of the Monroe County Democrats, Zach King, later this hour, and a lot to discuss. First, though, before I welcome my first guest this hour, an update on where the presidential race stands. And I'm a bit of sort of the politics junkie, so I'm just going to kind of stay with it here so you're kind of inside my brain on this. Wisconsin is a pretty well-done deal. It's a 20,000-vote margin for Joe Biden, nothing left to count. Former governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, says that's probably not going to flip. It's too much. Bill Stepien, President Trump's campaign manager, says they will request a recount. They're within one percentage point. They can do that by law, but not likely to flip. Michigan is nearly one percentage point ahead for Joe Biden now, with 94% of the vote in, and most of the outstanding vote is in Wayne County, and that is right outside Detroit. That's Detroit, and that is where Joe Biden has been leading 2-1. So one would assume, with a lead of well over 40,000 votes in Michigan, that it looks to be very comfortable for Joe Biden. But is anybody very comfortable about anything? Now, if Joe Biden has won Michigan and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania would not matter. If Joe Biden can hold Arizona and Nevada. Governor Scott Walker, who I just referenced, says he wants to be realistic. He doesn't think Trump's winning Wisconsin, his home state. But he thinks the networks were too early in calling Arizona. And we are still waiting for a lot of that data to come in, the final data in Arizona. So we wait on Arizona. Nevada, we're not going to know till tomorrow. Biden's got to hold both of those if he wants to win without Pennsylvania. There's one other little wrinkle, though. We are looking at Georgia. In Georgia, and I'm going to pull up the results right now because why not? Georgia has moved within about 80,000 votes statewide. There is about 8% of the vote still left to count total. So most of it's in. But in Georgia, we are looking at the outstanding vote being in pretty heavily Joe Biden favored areas. Is there enough still out to count? It looks like it may be a little bit more than Biden can overcome, 80,000 votes. I don't know, but that's one that they're not giving up on. Now it looks like it's about 75,000 votes. So Georgia would be huge for Biden. It would take Arizona essentially out of being required. So there's just a lot going on right now. And there's nothing definitive that I can tell you. I hope that helps you a little bit. Probably doesn't help with your anxiety. There's a lot of anxiety. Jeremy Cooney is a candidate for the 56th Senate District. And with a lead in the votes counted yesterday, and with a significant advantage in the registration of the mail-in vote, Jeremy Cooney declared victory last night. WXXI officially waiting to do that until we see more of the mail-in vote. But Jeremy Cooney, candidate in the Senate District number 56, is with us now. Welcome back to the program. How are you?
Hey, thanks, Evan. I have a little less anxiety as well.
A little less?
A little less anxiety, yeah. Yeah, you know, the numbers are starting to come in. We're starting to get a clearer picture of where different elections are wrapping up, not only across the U.S. with the presidential election, of course, that's foremost in all of our minds, but across New York State. We've got a lot of important state elections from both upstate and downstate. And, you know, as our Board of Elections are working so hard to get all the numbers tabulated and sorted, we're starting to see a better picture of what our state and local government can look like in 2021.
Well, how are you feeling right now? Let's just kind of go from the top down. When you look at this presidential race, did last night feel like 2016 to you, or did it feel different?
Well, I think 2016, you know, caught a lot of us by surprise. Those of us who are Democrats and who were perhaps a little bit more bullish on some of the polling that has been done around Hillary Clinton were, I think, surprised, dismayed, shocked. I still have trauma around thinking about the Javits Convention Center and that empty floor when the speech never happened. And, you know, I think we were prepared last night to, you know, really dig into numbers and not be overly confident and not call races before that they, you know, all the numbers had come in. So I felt a little bit better, but you know what last night's numbers showed to me, and I'm sure many of your listeners can agree, is how deeply divided our nation is, right? That this is not a, you know, a nation that has, you know, one or two outliers. There are very different views on so many issues that this nation sees pretty much across the table, across the aisle, if you will, very differently on. And, you know, we're a little insulated here in upstate New York, in New York in general. But when you talk about Wisconsin, when you talk about Michigan, you go county by county, you start to see that there are just different beliefs and ideologies that can differ maybe 15 miles apart from neighbors. So that I think we saw that on our screens last night. And I think we're starting to see that in some of the social commentary that's been evolving this morning.
Are you someone who is in the camp of, I would say, disappointed? I mean, one of the sentiments I'm seeing a lot among progressives online is, you know, even if we win, how could it have been this close? It shouldn't have been this close. This wasn't a great night. Or are you someone who thinks, just win, baby, win and figure out the rest later?
A little bit of both. I mean, I do, on the emotional side, I feel that. I feel that feeling of, like, how are we even having this conversation, right? I mean, how can we as Americans, you know, have a conversation around, let's talk about immigration or some of the non-economics, right? By the social sides, the climate change conversation around science, the handling of this pandemic, right? How are we even this close when we haven't had, I believe, a complete and total failure of leadership from the White House? So I feel that on the emotional side. But, you know, as someone who has been in public service for upwards of the last 20 years, you know, there is a practicality of the W, right? You need to win to be able to make the changes and the policy adjustments that we, so in my opinion, again, desperately need in this country. And so I am still very much hopeful for the vice president and for Kamala Harris to be victorious. I think that this is going to be, a long anxiety driven process. But I do believe in the end, you know, it comes down to what Joe Biden said at the very beginning of his campaign. This is a battle for the soul of our nation. And, you know, I think he was consistent with that message throughout his campaign. I think he brought some new ideas to the table, and I'm very hopeful that the remaining votes that have yet to be tabulated reflect a belief in his vision for our country.
Now, in your own race for the New York State Senate against Mike Berry, you decided to declare victory in that race. When it comes to the actual vote counted, it was very close. You had a slight edge in the vote that was counted yesterday alone, but we know that in the outstanding mail-in ballots, there is a significant edge in registration for Democrats. Now, Mike Berry says we should follow what they're saying at the national level. Count all the votes. You don't need to declare anything. What do you make of that?
That's fine. We, of course, will ensure that we are counting every vote. We want to make sure that everyone's voice was heard, whether they did, you know, absentee mail-in ballot or whether they showed up for early voting or on election day. But for me, this is a mass, determination here. I mean, this is a more than a significant lead, right? So we have, yes, we won, with the raw votes last night, but you look at the absentee ballots, where they were submitted from, where, you know, what party affiliation they were tied to. Obviously the Board of Elections will have to go through their process and will respect that process fully. But when you look at the numbers, about 31,500, and that was from maybe a day or two ago. So some additional absentee ballots can be received as long as they were postmarked yesterday. So if you look about that total, right, we're talking about a little over 2-to-1 advantage for Democrats. It's about 16,000 or so of the 31,000 ballots are from returned from Democrats. About 6,500 or so determined from Republicans. The rest are from unaffiliated voters. It makes it very difficult to see any sort of pathway to victory. I think even though the margin was close last night, with the tabulated votes. If we were down, or if my Republican opponent was up, that might be a different calculus. But based on the numbers that our team has crunched over and over and over again, we feel confident that we will be celebrating a victory and flipping this seat Democratic for the first time in 20 years.
Now, tell me what your first priority is if you do go to the New York State Senate, and we do see an opportunity for Democrats in the New York State Senate to have a kind of supermajority, to have a kind of check on the governor if the governor isn't moving in the direction that you want on policy. The governor has said his hands are tied when it comes to funding, that there needs to be help from the federal government. He has not supported a super wealth tax. He has not supported single-payer health care. What can you get done, and what do you want to go try to get done in your first year?
So I'm reflecting back on one of these Zoom candidates forums that we did leading up to the election. And the question that was asked of us was, in a hyper-partisan world, do you see a value in bipartisanship? And I thought that was an interesting question because, we talk about that on the congressional level a lot, but we don't necessarily talk about it at the state house level. And so what we saw, at least what we're starting to see, is a picture from what the Senate will look like, the state Senate will look like next year, is that we're going to see more upstate Democrats elected between Buffalo and Albany. But we're also still going to see, a significant majority membership of Republicans from upstate. So, my commitment is to make sure that we are delivering, whether they are school resource dollars, whether they are money for infrastructure, right? We know that budgets are going to be a challenge, but we know that infrastructure can be a good way to get people back to work, especially in this pandemic, for roads and bridges or other projects that we need here in the greater Rochester, Finger Lakes region area. And then also, I strongly feel the need to do more when it comes to how we're addressing health disparities in New York, but certainly, this is obviously a larger conversation nationally. If the pandemic taught us anything, it taught us that we have failed for years, low-income or communities of color, from accessing both physical and mental health services. And, I'd like to dig into that. That may mean that single payer can't come, and change the whole system right away. But there are investments that we can make in community medicine and community-based health services and insurance reimbursable programs to make sure that everyone has access to healthcare, especially as we're still navigating this pandemic. I do want to touch quickly on the federal stimulus package or bailout package, whatever language you want to use, because I think that is going to be critical for recovery of New York. We can't do this alone. And I do think that New York stands out from other states in this country with what we contribute to our nation's GDP, right? About 10% roughly of our nation's GDP comes out of New York State. We know that a lot of it comes out of financial services in New York City. And so there's a special obligation for the state senators and the state assembly people and the governor to really put a lot of pressure on our congressional delegation to make sure that we're getting our fair share out of Washington so that we can take care of our own folks here in New York, because we know a strong New York is a strong America. And, we saw that Speaker Nancy Pelosi was probably the most accurate in her predictions. They picked up a number of House seats. They protected some House seats. But on the Senate, the United States Senate side, a little more disappointing for Democrats, right? And a couple of really great candidates didn't go over the finish line. If this is a situation where the president is still the president going to 2021, we have to push harder to get a bailout package specifically for New York State. And I just don't think we've seen the state leadership come together to put that pressure on our federal government. And I'd like to be part of that push and that conversation. We're lucky to have, Congressman Joe Morelli here in Rochester. He gets it. He's already on board. But there are other folks who need to be convinced that New York is different than the rest of this country, that we do have a special need so that we can contribute more to our country's GDP.
All right. Last question for you. I've been asking candidates, who, no matter how things ended up for them, what you learned about the electorate nationwide and what you really learned from your own race. What did you learn about voters and Americans in this race?
I think that there's a thirst for information. You know, it would be very easy during a health pandemic to, you know, not knock on doors and just kind of put out Facebook ads or mailers or TV commercials and call it a day. Those of us who really took our civic responsibility seriously to, in my case, you know, we hosted a series of porch parties and we, you know, did Zoom forums and we made ourselves accessible to people. There's a lot of questions out there. And I think more people learned about the New York State Legislature in the past 7 months than I think, you know, really had an interest in this before. I mean, look at what's happening at our county level government, right? I don't think people really knew the function of the county legislature like they do now, you know, 2 years ago. So there's a heightened interest and there's a thirst of information for how policies impact our daily lives. And whether we're talking about Daniel Prude, and whether we're talking about the criminal justice reforms, whether we're talking about healthcare disparities, whether we're talking about public school funds and how that works, that mysterious foundation aid formula in Albany, people are looking to hold leaders accountable to their word. And so by being accessible and showing up, even in the healthcare crisis that we're in, we made that connection. And I think that's ultimately why we're successful.
Jeremy Cooney is a candidate for the 56th Senate District, and the numbers are in his favor at the moment, and we will see if they match his declaration of victory when we get some counts from the mail-in ballots, which heavily favor Democrats, it appears, in that race. Jeremy, thanks for making the time. I know we'll have more conversations in the weeks and months ahead.
Thanks so much, Evan. Stay well.
All right, let me bring in our next guest. It's Chris Misick, a candidate for the 55th Senate District, a Republican in that race who was up against Somra Brook, the Democrat. Chris, welcome back to the program. How are you doing this I was going to say this morning. It feels like morning. I've lost track of the time. How are you?
We were all up late last night, Evan. I'm doing well.
How much sleep? How much sleep for you?
It's a beautiful day. No, well, not much. You know, we were watching results come in until, boy, close to 2 in the morning. And as you know, I have a 3-year-old son who was up at 6:30. Come rain or shine, light or dark,
yeah,
he is up. So about 3.5 hours.
Okay. Now, in this particular race, it appears that the numbers are enough for your opponent, Somra Brook, to win. I know it's important to count everything. How do you feel about what you're seeing? Because obviously you had a very different number in Ontario County than Monroe County, but it's a question of where the gaps are and how it ends up. How do you see that race right now?
You know, it's remarkable what the turnout was in this district. It's also remarkable that, you know, running as a Republican, how many more votes we got than there are registered Republicans in this district. But I'm a man of science and math. I mean, that's what viticulture and winemaking is all about in the end. And doing the math, it does look like we'll likely fall short. With that said, we do need to make sure all the votes are counted. There's really no way we can certify this race yet. So I'm looking forward to see what, you know, the mail-in ballots show.
Any surprises for how things have gone in this? I mean, everybody who runs a race wants to win and then gets a sort of an expectation of best case, worst case. How did this one shape up, and did anything surprise you?
This whole year has been a surprise. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't active in any political activities. I wasn't on any boards all the way up until February when I decided to run for this seat. I was living my life and running my business. So entering this race and then going through the shutdown, the pandemic, summer of unrest, and all of the issues that are divisive that have impacted our community, you know, it's a very different type of campaign. I don't know that I would have even been prepared had I been in political office for what we faced this year. So it's been an interesting year. I have learned a lot, and I've connected with tens of thousands of wonderful people.
Now, when it comes to the issues that drove the votes the way they went in this district, there are a wide range of things that determine outcomes in a state Senate race like this. One of them is whether there's an incumbent. There was not. Two new faces and names for voters to learn about. Another is registration within a given district. And then it's the question of issues and what matters most to people. What was sort of the breakdown? How do you think that people ended up deciding on this, and what do you think were the issues that drove maybe a plurality or a majority of votes?
You know, I can't speak for my opponent's campaign. I can't speak for mine. And I can say this, that when you looked at the registrations, I knew coming into this, I was an underdog. You know, Senator Flunky had spent 40 years on TV. He was a local celebrity. And he was able to succeed and win multiple elections in what really is a Democratic district numerous times. I know I didn't have that coming in. Unless you'd been to Seneca Lake and tasted wine in my tasting room, you didn't know who I was. And so I think party ID, it was an incredibly important part of this. You know, Democrats have a 3-to-1 registration dominance in this district. And so the fact that we were able to overcome that tells me that my message of really public safety plus economic development really impacted a lot of Democrat and blank voters. You know, I came forward with a plan to establish an infrastructure bank, empowerment zones to establish new businesses, Buy American proposals, and supporting our law enforcement officers. There's a lot of folks who are scared right now, and there's a lot of folks in need. And these addressed those issues. So I'm proud of the message. You know, I said in one interview last night, Evan, even if I don't win, I hope this policy moves forward. I hope we can establish a better infrastructure base in this state, make it inventive, because this is how the lives of the folks of the 55th are going to get better.
I want to ask you a little bit about some of those issues that you just discussed, because I think the progressive side of the aisle, Chris, there is an idea of looking at policing, being frustrated and frankly angry at the state of policing in certain ways and in certain the disparities that we see in certain ways. But what you're also talking about is an electorate that your calculus was, and frankly, it sounds like your values reflect, wanted to hear a supportive message for policing, for law enforcement, and that you felt strongly about that and that you think that voters reflect that. Is it your view that Democrats are out of step on that issue?
You know, I came into this race not trying to be a politician. I cared less whether the word senator was in front of my name than whether we could right the ship that I feel had gone wrong on a number of different issues. I can't speak for Democrats who didn't vote for me. I can say that when it came to criminal justice reform, I was one of the first candidates out there demanding grand juries for officer-involved deaths of civilians when they aren't in self-defense, you know, wraparound services. I just believed that this was about addition and not subtraction. And I quite frankly, had never gotten an answer from a policy perspective, from a party perspective, from the Democrats, and exactly what defund was, because you hear different people say different things. So I was never opposed to that. But I have to say that I was influenced by my time in the service. And when you wear a uniform, I had spoken to a lot of vets from Vietnam who were spit on when they came back, and I had people shaking my hand and thanking me for my service. You know, when we see our law enforcement officers, by and large, they're good folks, and by and large, they face dangerous situations. I think it's an important thing in a civil society to thank and support those who do a service that we cannot or will not do ourselves. So I wanted to be a voice for that.
All right. Before I let you go, then, let me just talk about where you see this electorate going. Because, as you know, whenever there's a national election, both parties are going to take stock and decide, what are we learning from the numbers? What are we learning about who voted for us and who did not vote for us? What are we learning about what this country is expressing it wants? Right now, we don't know who the president is going to be. You know, betting markets have Joe Biden as a favorite to pull this out now, but also betting markets had Trump at a 5-to-1 favorite at about 10 p.m. last night. So let's wait. Let's see where the votes are. What we know is it's going to end up being very close. What do you think we're learning about this electorate, and what did you learn in this race?
I came into this race with an idea that there is an elite that is totally separated. They live different lives than most of us in the working and middle class. They don't understand our issues. They believe that Shangri-La can be just around the corner with the right policy fixes. And I believe that we aren't doing enough for the American worker, and we need to focus on reshoring our manufacturing. You know, at this point, I'm hoping that whoever is president shares that value, because we're seeing the divide. I mean, the Gini coefficient continues to expand, this separation between the extreme haves and the have-nots. This isn't healthy for society. It'll lead to even more civil discord. It'll lead to less respect for our republic. These are the things that are fundamental to a healthy society. These are the things that we need to focus on in both parties. We'll have different policy prescriptions, but I think we have, by and large, again, you know, the elite, the institutions in our society, they've lost sight of this, and we need to refocus on that.
Chris, thanks for making the time. Chris Misick is a candidate in the 55th Senate District for New York State. His opponent, Samra Brouk. It appears right now that Ms. Brouk has the numbers to win, but they're going to count all of the votes wisely. I think that's wise in every state and every corner of the country. But Chris, I know we'll talk again. Thanks for making time for the program.
Great. Thanks so much, Evan. Hope to see you around.
All right. So here's where we are. In a moment, we're going to come back and welcome more guests. And I want to let listeners know that NPR expects that Joe Biden will be speaking at around 2 o'clock. If it happens before 2 o'clock, obviously you're going to hear it live, and we will take it live. If it does not, stay with WXXI AM 1370 for Here and Now to hear that. If you're on WRUR, you can hear Here and Now on the stream or WXXI AM 1370 or on WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio. So I think producer Megan Mack, who's also engineering, Megan is doing everything. This is one of those days. She's making another phone call. So what we'll do is if we get it before 2, we'll take it. It sounds like it's going to be after 2, but we'll let our listeners know. She's saying probably. It's fluid. We're going to keep you up to date on that. What I'm going to do now is give you a quick reset on the presidential side before we bring in our next guest. How's that, Megan Mack? Yeah? Oh, you're on a break right now. Let's take a break, our only break of the hour. Let's do that now. I'll get you recapped on where we are with the presidential election and more guests on the other side. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we talk to some of the winners in local politics, the state level, federal level, right down to the local level. We'll talk people who ran and won. We'll talk to someone who ran and did not win. And we'll try to take stock of everything that's happening on the national level to get caught up on where things stand. A recap and a look ahead Wednesday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Joe Biden will be speaking, according to NPR, sometime around 2 o'clock. We don't know what he's going to say. I mean, it certainly doesn't seem like a victory declaration is anywhere in the offing, and probably shouldn't be based on what we're seeing. But even if you want to give him Michigan and Wisconsin, which look, by the numbers, now approaching a pretty safe territory for Joe Biden, he has to hold Arizona, he's got to hold Nevada, and he would win the presidency. He could flip Georgia. It's possible that would be tight. And in Pennsylvania, he could win Pennsylvania, even if he loses Arizona and Nevada. Jeffrey Skelly, writing for 538.com, says the following. If you're wondering how exactly a blue shift in Pennsylvania could be significant enough for Biden to overcome Trump's 8-point lead there, consider a small batch of votes that just came in from Allegheny County. About 4,700 new votes were reported there, and Biden won nearly 80% of those votes. It's important to understand that a lot of the outstanding mail-in ballots in Pennsylvania are not only from populist Democratic-leaning areas, but are also going to be even more Democratic than those areas on the whole, because Democrats were far more likely to vote by mail. And while there are some outstanding votes from more rural GOP areas in Pennsylvania, it's the large number of strongly Democratic mail-in ballots that could boost Biden enough to overtake Trump. Will that happen? We'll have to wait and see. Pennsylvania, still up in the air. I want to bring in the chair and the vice chair of the Monroe County Democratic Party. Zach King and Stephen DeVay are with us. Zach, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well, Evan. How about yourself, Zach?
I have no idea. I've barely slept. I can barely see straight. Stephen, how are you?
I'm doing sounds about the same as you. Yeah.
let's talk a little bit about how both of you are sort of taking the swings that have really been wild in the last, oh boy, now again, it looks about 18 hours or so. Zach, were you ready for this, or is it hard emotionally to see what we're seeing on the national level and kind of hang in there?
You know, I think we were all kind of prepared for an elongated results tolling in. You know, I think we were ready for it. I think we all kind of knew that there was going to be what we referred to as the red mirage on election day, with people who showed up to the polls because, you know, as you just mentioned, most of the absentee ballots that came in and were mailed in were tend to lean more heavily towards Democratic enrollment. So, you know, as we look forward to the next couple days and weeks, you know, I want to just urge patience with everyone because we need to make sure that every ballot gets counted. So I think at the moment we're just trying to hold tight.
Steve, I know you're a numbers guy. When you look at what's going on the national level, would you rather be on Team Trump or Team Biden?
I mean, regardless of the numbers, I would rather be on Team
Biden. No, that's not the question. It's the numbers. It's the numbers.
No, I mean, looking at the numbers and with what is outstanding and with what, you know, we know for the folks that generally kind of took advantage of the absentee and those programs and the ballots that are really are left to be counted, I would rather be on Team Biden, even data-wise.
Okay. Anything surprise you from what you're seeing so far? I mean, one of the narratives that we're going to hear is that the polls were wrong again. What do you make of it?
I think that the polls are all over the place is something that we've got to figure out what the discrepancy that is happening between what folks are willing to say on the phone when they're in front of somebody and what they are doing when they get to the ballot box, because those continue to seem to be different. Continue to show different results and are leading with that narrative of the polls are being wrong. But I think we really have to ask ourselves, what is the methodology that we're doing to get those polls?
Right. But Stephen, I think what I'm trying to understand is this. The polls nationally 4 years ago weren't that far off. The polls in some states were pretty far off. Some were pretty close. But just about everything in the polling last year ended up going in Trump's favor. It's close to the same this year. I don't see Biden outperforming polls just about anywhere. Maybe we could find a few, but for the most part, it's the same story. However, when you look at 2018 in the midterm elections, the polls were pretty good. And is there something unique about Donald Trump as a candidate that has changed how people talk to pollsters? Or is there something shifting in the electorate and pollsters in general are not effectively handling how they're measuring support?
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting kind of scenario. You know, personally, I would lean potentially a little bit more towards there is something about Trump and the supporters of Trump that I think is leading to his turnout and his base causing some of these differences. You know, again, with what they are willing to say in the poll, what they're willing to respond to there. I do think that there is something very different about that than what we've seen. You know, for example, when you gave the 2018 numbers, he wasn't on the ballot, right? So there does seem to be something very specific related to I think, him.
Well, okay.
Also,
go ahead, Zach.
If I may also chime in here, I think that there's also a factor that we're not really discussing here in that the pandemic really changed how people had to campaign. Which is something that you can't really compare to with previous years. So I think, and I've been questioning this throughout the day as to whether or not, you know, the fact that people couldn't go out and knock doors as much, the fact that we were only, for the most part, making phone calls or doing Zoom meetings or events, I think that really hindered the ability of a lot of Democrats, you know, across the board to really get their messages out and make sure that they got more people out to the polls. So I think the pandemic also plays a big factor here in how the polling was different from what we've seen in terms of who showed up to vote.
So let me hit that point one more time, Zach. So I think you're saying, tell me if I'm wrong here. I think you're saying that Democrats were more reticent to go door to door to do the kind of campaigning, politicking, rallies because of the pandemic. Republicans were more willing to just do that. And that cost Democrats at least in some margins.
Well, I wouldn't say that the Republicans doing it really changed that. I mean, really, the only thing that the Republicans did differently than Democrats is holding the massive rallies. Generally speaking, Republicans don't do as much door-to-door, field campaigning. But I would say that the fact that the Democrats couldn't do that definitely plays a large factor in the turnout of Democrats.
All right. So let's talk a little bit now about where the party goes and you know, Zach and Stephen are going to tell us that it's too early. Let's make sure we count everything first. I take that point. But what we do know at this point is the United States did not give a landslide victory to Donald Trump's opponent. There was not a widespread repudiation of Trumpism. so to speak, in politics. Donald Trump remains a candidate who can get well over 60 to 65 million, if not more, votes. He's not going to win the popular vote, but he's got a chance in the Electoral College again, despite a pandemic, despite the economy, despite many other factors. And what that has produced, Zach, is this debate on the left, which sounds something like this. Well, if only we would have followed where the party wants to go. Look at Florida. They just voted for Trump, but they also voted for a $15 minimum wage. Look at Fox News. 71% of Fox News polls said they wanted health insurance for all Americans. So the Democratic Party should have gone in that direction. But then you've got some saying, hey, the AOCing of the Democratic Party has scared people. Americans are scared of the specter of going too far to the left and have rejected Democrats almost preemptively, and that the Democrats need to still tack to the center. Where do you want to see the party go? Is any one of those arguments compelling to you?
Well, I think the real argument and the real question here is how much of this of what we're seeing is an effect of Trump's policies or the cult of personality that has been built around Donald Trump. I believe that his supporters are probably one of the most fervent supporters in terms of how much they actually like their candidate. So really, I think a big question here comes down to how much is he the factor here rather than the policies themselves. So I think focusing more in on that rather than what the, party's, direction moving forward is, I think that's more of something we should pay more attention to.
Stephen, how do you see it?
Yeah, I think that the example that you gave in Florida with the $15, minimum wage and that passing and then him winning, there's clearly, I think, an appetite for some of these progressive policies. As you mentioned, healthcare is polling really well and people want it. The minimum wage is polling really well. But people are still very drawn to Trump. And there is a disconnect that happens there, right? Because Trump and the Republicans are for sure not the party of the $15 minimum wage, but it is something that people want. So I think that those progressive ideals are things that people are catching on to and that they want. And that's clear in how they're voting. But they don't seem to be connecting the fact that it is the Democratic Party that tends to be in favor of those progressive ideas and not Trump and the Republican Party.
All right. So before I let both of you guys go here, let me ask you about locally here. Locally, statewide, and what we're seeing here in our own community. Zach King, first of all, any surprises for you? In a moment, we're going to talk to Mark Johns, who appears to be poised to hold on and go back to the New York State Assembly. I know Jen Lunsford has made a hard push in that race. She wants every vote counted, and of course that's wise, as we've been saying about all races. Was that a surprise to you, Zach, so far, and anything else that stands out as a surprise?
I don't think there's so much of a surprise. As I mentioned before, we kind of expected to see the red mirage. And when you look at the amount of absentee ballots that are currently out and have been mailed into the Board of Elections, we're looking at over 100,000 votes have not actually been counted yet in any of the results that we've seen. And that doesn't include any ballots that have not gotten to the Board of Elections, because they can be received up until November 10th. So long as they were postmarked from yesterday on Election Day. So I think that we still have a lot of time to see what comes in. And I think, calling victory either which way is a bit premature. So making sure that we're counting every absentee ballot is pivotal for what we're going to see move over the next couple weeks.
Stephen, was there enough of a blue wave to satisfy you, or do you think that there was a little bit of a letdown nationally and in the races that you saw in New York State?
I think that a lot of folks would have preferred a much stronger message to be sent, that Trumpism and the policies that he enacts and that he believes in and that he enforces aren't what represents us as a country. So, I think I stand with a lot of other folks that wish that it was a little bit of a stronger wave, so to speak, on Election Day. But I do think that we will see some more of that kind of that wave building as we continue to see more ballots come in.
I want to thank both of you for making the time to be with us on the program today. Zach King is the chair of the Monroe County Democratic Committee. Thanks for being with us. I know we'll have a lot more to talk about in the months to come.
Thank you, Evan.
The vice chair, Stephen DeBay. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Let's welcome now, an incumbent in the 135th Assembly District. It's Mark Johns, who, based on the numbers, is poised to hold off Jen Lunsford, the Democrat challenging him in that seat. We got to count all the ballots. Mark, welcome. How are you feeling about that race today?
Well, I guess pretty good. Evan, how are you doing?
I guess I'm fine.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Who needs sleep, Mark Johns?
Yeah, exactly. What do they say? I'll sleep when I'm dead. You know? just to follow up on some of the things that I heard just previously, I actually am a guy that is out there door-to-door. I had a Buffalo Bills face mask on, and I was out there, and I put a key card on a door, and then I would knock, ring the bell, step back, social distancing, and I would, pitch the ideas that I'm kind of famous for now.
So let's talk about this race here. When we see the absentee and the votes are going to be counted by mail, you know, your opponent does point out that the registration favors Democrats, that there's still a hope that there's enough to swing it. I just want to make sure I understand your characterization of what you expect to happen next.
Well, consider that probably 20% of the Democrats voted for me. I think I should do okay. Biden voters voted for me. Joe Morelli's voters voted for me. Some of them is what I'm saying. And, I am the most independent member of the New York State Legislature by a long shot. I mean, I vote with the Democrats close to 95% of the time. Half the people in my district think I am a Democrat, you know. And I was backed by the Independence Party for a number of the reform issues that I stand for. And I think that it may tighten up a little, but over 6,000 votes ahead, I think I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah, Mark, you are a different kind of Republican. I'm not even sure what you were rooting for in terms of the presidential outcome. I mean, if the president loses, are you going to be disappointed?
I accept the will of the people. I accept the will of the voters. I do in my race, and I do in the presidential race. And to be honest with you, I had a problem with them trying to rub out third parties in this state. I mean, they tried to get rid of the Green Party, the Working Families Party, the Independence Party, the Libertarian Party. What's that all about? I mean, what about diversity? What about more voices, more opinions? How about that? And then they say, well, you got to have 130,000 votes on the presidential line of your history. Why are two parties out there deciding that other parties can't even exist? I mean, that's terrible.
So let me ask you then about the issues that you think matter to your voters. But before I even kind of get into that, when you say that some of your voters think that you are a Democrat based on your voting record, you are a Republican. What does it mean to you to be a Republican? What does it mean in 2020 to be a Republican?
Well, for me, it means balancing budgets and being fiscally responsible, which I think is what conservative used to mean. And, to be honest with you, like I said, people maybe don't know what I stand for, but I'll put it this way, Evan, you may know this and other people may. I've had a lot of Democrats say, Mark, why don't you just switch party affiliation? And I always say, what's the difference? Whether I'm a Democrat or Republican, I'm still going to be talking about the issues that I talk about. It doesn't make any difference what my background is or what name I have on the ballot. I could be a complete independent. I'm still talking about the issues that I think matter to 80%+ of the people. The extremes, yeah, the extremes aren't necessarily going to be with me, but we're a nation of people that are 60% to 80% in the middle, like I am, like probably you are.
So do you think that both parties then, I mean, you're critical at times of your own party, do you think both parties are too often ignoring the political middle?
I think so, and I'm right in the middle. And you know what? When you get 55-60% of the vote every time, I think that, look, this was a bad year. I only got 55% of the vote, and this was a terrible year. You know, I had big money from New York City coming after me, and this was not a great time to run. Trump was bringing down the top of the ticket, and the wave was not in my favor, but, I jumped on a surfboard and surfed the wave and wind up doing okay.
Well, your opponent had said that, you know, that you talk sort of a good game on a lot of these issues, but you end up voting a different way.
Well, hold on, Evan. I vote with the Democrats 95% of the time. What, that isn't good enough?
I'm simply sort of observing the state of the race. But I am curious to know, considering you do vote with Democrats quite a bit, you know, what we saw in Florida last night, Assemblyman Johns, was we saw Florida vote for Donald Trump by about 4 points. We also saw Florida pass a $15 minimum wage. And, you know, for the people who are perplexed by that, I mean, it strikes me as possible that this country is a little bit more socially conservative and economically liberal. And I'm curious, because it sounds like you're a little bit more the opposite of that, but I don't know. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Pretty good observation. I'm fiscally conservative and socially moderate. I mean, I didn't vote for the late-term abortion bill, but, you know, I've certainly voted for all the women's rights issues, despite what you see on TV. You know, the bottom line is we need obvious reforms. How about campaign finance reform? How about the fact that somebody can't spend $500,000 or outspend you 5 or 10 to 1 and call it a fair race? I mean, and this is not about my particular contest, but in general, the richest candidate usually wins. And the people that are well-connected, you know, they know the rich lawyers and lobbyists from New York City, they have Wall Street money and whatever other money they have, they generally wind up winning because it's a money game. And I think it should be about issues. It should be the message over the money.
Do you find yourself thinking about the electorate in any different way after yesterday, whether it's your own voters or your own constituents, I should say, who voted for you and not for you, and the American people in general? Is there anything you felt like you learned from this particular election?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what. I have the best district in the state. I have the most independent-minded, independent-thinking district in the state by a long shot. I'm the most independent member of the state legislature by a long shot. And I will tell you that the people in this district care about issues. And I'm the issues candidate. I didn't run a negative campaign. You know, I talked about issues. I do a lot of constituent service. As I said, I was 30-plus years working for government, helping people out. So what I do at the state assembly level is just an extension of that. I mean, I'm famous, I think, now for calling people back. And believe me, I call people back from all around the state and actually from around the country. Somehow my name got out there. I was calling people from New Jersey, Las Vegas, Los Angeles. It's unbelievable, but I call people back. And I think that's a big part of it. You are a civil servant or a government servant. You're supposed to serve the people. I'm never going to forget the fact that the people are paying my salary, and I'm going to do everything I can for the next 2 years to make everybody proud of the fact that I represent them, I work hard, and I do it as a full-time job. It will not be a part-time job for me ever.
All right, last question for you. New York State, in a tight spot like all states because of the pandemic, has to make a lot of decisions about either where cuts need to be or what decisions need to be made to make sure the state can handle its responsibilities, deal with the pandemic, try to be helpful to businesses. What's your priority as you go into 2021 in the legislature?
Well, obviously, fighting off the pandemic. As I said, I worked in public health and disease control, among other things. So that's number one. Let's get the pandemic under control, not only at the state and the federal level, but at the worldwide level. Look at where the virus is going up. It's going up in liberal, left-wing European countries. I mean, there are problems all over the place. Trump obviously misplayed it, but so did a lot of other people in the beginning. And, you know, we need to take the virus seriously, and we need to worry about balancing budgets and making sure our economy is going to be strong going forward.
Thanks for making the time, as always, Mr. Assemblyman, and we'll see how the rest of the mail-in votes come in. And I know we're going to talk many more times in the weeks and months to come.
Well, I want to thank everybody for the district for coming out, and it's a real honor to be able to represent them again.
All right, that's Assemblyman Mark Johns, who a frequent caller, frequent guest, and someone you'll hear plenty of times on this program. We hope to talk to Jen Lunsford, his opponent, the Democrat in the race, who is still hoping that those mail-in ballots can bring a big number her way and flip that race, and we're going to see when the rest of those ballots are counted. We talked in the last 2 hours to a lot of people in local politics, in state politics, people who have worked in political organizing. And I know, listeners, you've got a lot of emotions and a lot going through your mind as you watch the results here and around the country. Keep in touch with us if you want to see us follow certain ideas, races, etc. I was fascinated by Florida going for Donald Trump and a $15 minimum wage. We're going to talk about that. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about the president's big inroads in the Latino community. We'll talk about that, and there's a lot more to talk about as well. So keep us in mind, and you can always email us, connections@wxxi.org. Megan Mack is the producer, and today, also the engineer and the writer and the mind and the booker and someone who just basically did everything except for grab this microphone. I'm Evan Dawson. Always happy to be with you. Have a peaceful afternoon. We will talk to you tomorrow, one way or another, on member-supported public radio.